Hello, I'm Gideon Rothstein, and this is Perek Yud Dalet of Malachim Aleph, the 14th chapter of the Book of Kings. In today's Perek, we are going to learn about the prediction of Yeravam's end, and then his actual end, the end of Yeravam's kingdom, and the predictions made about it. And it starts, or we see the beginning of the end, with the falling ill of Yeravam's son Aviyah. Pasuk Aleph tells us, "Ba'itahi chala Aviyah ben Yeravam, Achiyah the son of Yeravam, fell ill. So vayom Yeravam liishto kumina vehishtanit velo yedu kiat eshet Yeravam alach shilo. Hinei sham Achiyah hanavi hu diber alai lemelech al hamazeh. Go to Shilo, because there there's Achiyah hashiloni, Achiyah the prophet, who spoke about me to become the king of this people." This is reminding us of this line that Yeravam walks between faith and lack of faith. He's telling his wife to go to Achiyah, because Achiyah is the one who predicted that he would become the monarch, and that came true. And yet, at the same time, he's telling her to disguise herself so that the people around Achiyah don't recognize her, and therefore they won't be able to tell him who she is. We're going to see in Pasuk Dalet that Achiyah is blind, so he wouldn't be able to know it on his own. So Yeravam apparently thinks that he's going to be able to have his wife get in and out without Achiyah realizing who she is, but also get accurate prophecy as to what's going to be about the boy. Because if you see in Pasuk Gimel, "V'lakachat biyadeich asar alechem," you take the presents, 10 loaves of bread, v'nikudim, uvakbuk divash, and a bottle of nikudim are like crackers, uvakbuk divash is a bottle of honey, uvatelan, and come to him, hu yagid lach mayelanar, he'll tell you what will be about the boy. So just listen to Yeravam. What he apparently is assuming is that she'll be able to get in and out without him knowing that she's Yeravam's wife, but with him knowing what will happen to the boy. So it suggests that there's this odd belief in prophecy. It's not that you're talking to God or that God is sending you messages. It's that you're connecting in some way with the future, and you can do it in a very narrow way, and you get spots of visions that don't cover everything. So that it would be possible for Achiyah in some way to focus his thoughts, let's say, on this woman. This woman, I don't know who she is, but she has a son. What's going to happen with the son? And she'll have a vision of what happens to the son, and then he'll be able to tell her what's going to happen to her son. That's not our vision of prophecy, but that's what he seems to be assuming. Otherwise, his actions are self-contradictory. She does it. She gets to Achiyah's house. Achiyah is now old enough that he's no longer able to see. He has a degenerative eye condition, and therefore he is blind. So Hashem comes to Achiyah ahead of time, gives him the prophecy, tells him that it is Yeravam's wife. She's coming about her son. This is what you should tell her, and you should know that she's disguising herself. So that's something that Achiyah cannot know on his own, because he is, after all, blind. People around him presumably wouldn't be able to know, because they don't know that she's his wife. They'll just see the disguise. So this is what he does in Pasuk Vav. Vayhi chishmoa Achiyahu et kol ragleha ba'a ba'fetach vayomer bo yeshet Yeravam lamaze at mit nakera v'anochi shaluach elayech kasha. So as soon as he hears her footsteps at the door, he says, "Come in, Yeravam's wife. Why are you trying to disguise yourself? I have a heavy, harsh message for you." L'chi imrili Yeravam komar Hashem Elokei Yisrael ya'an asher harimoticha mitoch ha'am va'aitencha nagid al ami Yisrael. Go say, tell your husband, this is what Hashem says, and then the message that he begins with is to heighten our recognition of what has happened to David and his family, and to heighten our recognition of the failure of Yeravam. Hashem says, "I lifted you up from among the people, and I made you the ruler over my people." My people, Israel. Something we don't think about, because we are sort of the descendants of the tribes of Judea, of Yehudah, and we connect to the Beit HaMikdash in our history, in our theology, in our ideology. So therefore we sort of think of that as the real Jewish people, and they of course have the continuation of the Davidic line. But that's not quite the way Hashem is sort of, not that Hashem experiences things, but if you'll allow me to borrow the metaphor, that's not the way Hashem is experiencing it. Hashem is saying to Yeravam, "I made you king over my people Israel. Pazakhet, Vaikrat HaMamlacham Beit David, Vaitnehalach, and I tore away the kingdom from David and I gave it to you. And that, the reason Hashem is saying this, and that it's accurate, is because after all, the majority of the tribes, the vast majority, right, 10 of the tribes out of 12, and the majority of the people are with Yeravam. So if you had to pick the Jewish people and say, who is right now ruling the Jewish people, it's Yeravam. So I tore the Malamlacha away from David. I gave, the way Hashem said it before, I gave David one shavit, so he shouldn't be out of anything. And then he says to Yeravam, there's this disappointed, V'lo hayita ke'avdi David, hasher shemar mitzvotai, v'asher halach acharai b'chol levavo, l'asa rak hasher b'einai. You don't like David. David kept my mitzvos. He followed me with all his heart. He wanted to do only that which was right and good in my eyes. Vatara la'asod, and you, Yeravam, are terrible. You're doing very bad things. Mikol asher yu lefanecha, from all that have gone before you, this is not what's been true of Jewish history thus far. What did he do, Yeravam? Vatelech vatasalecha elohim acharim umasechot lahachiseni, yoti shlachta achrei gevecha. You made other gods, an idol, and a molten idol to worship to anger me. And me, you've thrown, hishlachta acharei gevach, you've thrown behind your back. So, on the first half of that, that Yeravam made idols, question is how you want to read it. Does it mean that he actual idol worship, or is it only a reference to the agalim that he made in Beit El and Dan? The distinction perhaps is insignificant, except that at least in theory, the idols of Beit El and Dan, the Agalim of Beit El and Dan, were the Shem Hashem. Of course, Hashem doesn't see it that way, and therefore Hashem is free to refer to it as Elohim Lacharim. The question is, how early did idol worship invade the Northern Kingdom? If you take it literally, it's right from the beginning. We'll have to follow that as Malachim continues. And then this pasuk of Oti Shlachta Acharei Gevecha, you've thrown me behind your back. I just think it's interesting to notice that the Gemara in Brachot uses this pasuk as an example or a characteristic of what happens if somebody eats before they daven, before they pray in the morning. There is a general principle that the pasuk of lo tochlu al adam, you can't eat al hadam, means several things. It's often given as the classic example of what's called a lav shebichlalut, of a lav that encompasses many different aspects of Judaism. That will not be counted, by the way, as a lav in the Torah, even though it's actually more than one lav in the Torah. The Rambam makes it a rule that you don't count the lav shebichlalut, and that's generally accepted, and yet it's not because it's not legal, or not halachic, or not a mitzvah, it's because it's so broad and encompassing, we don't count it. So in the case of that one, it covers a couple of things. It covers not eating blood, but it also covers the rabbinic idea, or the Torah idea, that you should not eat in the morning until such time as you have davened to Hashem. When you wake up in the morning, the first thing you do to protect yourself and to be aware of human mortality and of human needs is daven to Hashem, and after that you pay attention to your physical needs. When the Gemara talks about that whole issue, it points to somebody who eats before they daven, as voti shlachta acharei gevecha, of throwing God behind their backs. Pasuk Yud, lachein. So because of all this, because Yeravam has done these things and acted in these improper ways, I'm going to bring evil to the house of Yeravam. I will cut off from Yeravam Mashtin Bekir Atzur Ve'azuv B'Yisrael. I'm going to take away from Yeravam. Atzur Ve'azuv is a hard phrase. Atzur is somebody who's held in, and Azuv is somebody who's neglected. So we'll get back to that in a second, but even before that, the phrase Mashtin Bekir. So Mashtin Bekir, most literally, probably means people who urinate in the wall, and therefore it might mean a dog. There won't even be dogs who are generally urinate against the wall. My English is very circumspect and says, we'll cut off from Yeravam every male person. So that would mean just those who might have tended to be Mashtin Bekir. And then Rashi and Radak quote, the Aramaic, that Mashtin Bekir means somebody who is Meshit Eitzot, who can figure out the way life works. Whatever the exact meaning of the phrase is, the curse is that nobody will be left from the house of Yeravam. Uviarti acharivet Yeravam kashiv era galal ad tumo. And I'm going to destroy after Yeravam as the galal destroys until everything is done. Now, everything is gone. And my English talks about yivera galal ad tumo as a man takes away dung until it is all gone. I just will note that the Gemara in Bava Kamma uses this pasuk as some proof that bet ayin resh biur refers to eating things until they're all gone, and that's why hahever is considered habor habor ashor habor habor hahever. I forget, something like that. That is because of that. This is a proof as to the meaning of the kinds of nizikin. The point, though, obviously, of the curse is that it's going to be all gone. Hamet liravam ba'ir yichlu aklavim. Those who die in the city will be eaten by dogs. Hamet pasadeh yichlu of hashamayim. And those who die in the open will be eaten by the birds. Ki Hashem diber, because Hashem has spoken. So this is obviously a very sad outcome for the family of Yeravam. But that's a prediction. Ve'at kumi l'chi leveitech. And then he says, and you go home. So he says, when you get to the city, the boy will die. It ends up being that the boy dies when she gets to her house, but the boy's going to die. So aside from everything else, the mission on which she came to this Navi, she's being told, is also going to turn out bad, that the boy himself will die, and he'll die immediately. He's dying right now. The consolation is, v'safdulo kol Yisrael v'kavru oto. He will be properly mourned and buried. Kizel levado yavol l'ravam el kever. Another aspect, another element to the prediction, because this alone of the house of Yeravam, meaning this Aviyam, this Aviyah will be the only member of the family who will come to burial. Kizel levado yavol l'ravam el kever. Yan nimtza bo devar tov el Hashem Elokei Yisrael. Because there's been something good found in him by Hashem, the God of the Jewish people, among the whole house of Yeravam. So the Gemara talks about what was the good thing that was found in him, and they have two suggestions. One suggestion is that he himself refused to guard the roads to Yerushalayim to stop people from going, or perhaps more broadly, that he stopped the whole thing of guarding the roads. They couldn't fight his father completely. His father had said, you don't go to Yerushalayim for Chag, and he set up counter Chags. But the tradition is that not only did he do that, he set up watchmen along the roads to stop people from going to Yerushalayim, even if his competitor, Agalim, competitor worships, had not succeeded. And then Aviyah, either personally and his group, or even more broadly, making sure that everybody stopped doing it, stopped the prohibition and stopped the fighting against those whom the Spirit moved, to go to Yerushalayim. And he was the only member of the house of Yeravam who did that, and therefore he dies, but he gets some lessening in that he comes to proper burial. As we've noticed before, proper burial is an issue in Malachim. We've spoken a little bit about it on other occasions as to why they cared so much about it, but it would seem to have been a marker of whether or not you succeeded in life. And it always raises it again and often raises a question that should be asked all the time as to what would have happened if Yeravam had not had support from his entire family. People often see punishments like this and wonder at collective punishment, and they say, how is it fair? Yeravam does terrible things. He sets up a competitor worship. He sets up Agalim in Beit El and Dan. He does this and he does that, and he fails Hashem, and who gets punished? Him for sure, but his whole family. How is that fair? So I think this noting that there was one thing positive found in Yeravam, in Aviyah ben Yeravam, and that therefore lessened his punishment, suggests what should be seen as true, which is that very often, if not always, in situations of collective punishment, the others being punished have been at least complicit, at least passive, and often complicit in what's going on. So we say, well, but they didn't do the actual crime. They were only complicit. So I think that the Navi is suggesting to us that complicit is not as innocent as we often would tend to think of it being. And that's what's going on here. So Pasuk Yidal, Vekim Hashem lo melech ha-Yisrael sh'yachrit ha-pein yaravam zeh hayom v'megamata. So Hashem will find somebody else who will become king over the Jewish people, and it will completely wipe out the house of Yeravam, those who are already alive, and any others who are produced, they will be completely wiped out. Pasuk Ten Vav, V'yikah Hashem et Yisrael kasher yanud hakaneh b'mayim v'natash et Yisrael me'al adamah tovah azot asher natan l'avotehem v'zeiram me'ever l'nahar ya'an asher asu et asherehem machisim et Hashem. Here it's more explicit that it's asherot and that therefore it's idol worship. But v'yikah Hashem Yisrael, Hashem will punish Yisrael, the northern kingdom, Ka'ashir Yanud Hakaneba Mayim, as a reed is thrown about in the water, and make the Jews and kick the Jews out of this good land. Right? This is the first expression or threat of exile that was given to their forefathers, and will throw them to the other side of the river because of the Asherim, Asherot, the idols that they've done, which anger Hashem. One of the things to wonder about is how would a proper people have reacted to this situation? The history of the northern kingdom is they're going to ignore this basically, and they're going to be evil all the way through, and they'll have very few redeeming kings in that northern kingdom, if any. But what would have happened had they changed at this point? So we know the answer to that question because we have the book of Jonah, we have the book of Yonah. I also noticed that Chazal point out that here Achiah is giving a heavy curse. He's announcing a heavy curse to the wife of Yeravam, and yet Chazal noticed the metaphor that he uses is Kasher Yanura Kaneh B'mayim. So when a reed is thrown about in the water, it's not completely destroyed. It's moved from place to place, but it eventually returns to its place. It's not necessarily even uprooted completely. It's moved around. And so Chazal points out that Achiah's curses are better than Bilam's brachot. Because if you look at the brachot of Bilam, they're not even as good as that. So that's a mark of what it means to be a prophet among the Jewish people. It is to balance both a fidelity to the truth and to God with a lasting and a lingering compassion for the Jewish people, that even when you are required to announce curses and punishments for the Jewish people, you do it in a way and with a metaphor that can minimize it or that can leave hope for the future. Pasuk Tetzayin, V'yitena Yisrael Biglal Chatot Yeravam Asher Chata Asher Chitia Yisrael. And this will happen to the Jewish people. It will happen to Yisrael because of the sins of Yeravam, that he sinned, Vasherechti Yisrael, and that he caused the Jews to sin. This phrase is quoted in Pirkei Avot. It is famous for epitomizing the notion of a chote umakti, which is much worse than committing your own sins. Commit your own sins, it means you're weak, or it means you have problems, or it means you have faith issues. You cause others to sin. It may also mean that you have faith issues, but then you've now exported them, and now you've lured other people into your trap, and you've ruined their lives, and you've ruined their spirituality, and that's always seen as much worse. And here, it's already predicting, in the first king of the northern kingdom, it's already leading to a prediction, which will come true fairly soon, of exile and of uprootedness. So she goes home. He ba'a. She gets to the doorstep, and the boy dies. Like Bruto, Vayispidu, Lokol Yisrael. So they bury him and they mourn him. As God had said, at the hands of Achiah. And now we come to the summary of Yeravam's kingdom. So that he fought his battles that he fought, and his kingdom that he did. Another reminder that the book we have in front of us is not a history book, because we didn't even know that Yeravam really fought wars, and we're finding it out now. So the wars Yeravam fought, and the kingship that he had, they start their own history book, and you have a Sefer Divrei Hayamim, the Malchei Yisrael. Vayamim, Hashem Malach Yeravam, Esim Ushtayim Shana. He was king for 22 years. Vayishkav Mavotav, Vayimloch Nadav Bino Tachtav. And so he dies, and his son becomes king after him, or in his place. We now switch back to Rechavam in the southern kingdom. Rechavam ben Shlomo Malach B'Yehuda, Rechavam ben Malcho. He's 41. As I noted, his father was king for 40 years. That would suggest that his father had him before he took over the throne. He was king for 17 years. That's a reminder that Yerushalayim, where he's ruling, even though he's only the king over one tribe, that is the center of the world in God terms, because God chose that city to place his name there, of all the tribes of the Jewish people. V'shem imo Na'ama ha'amonit. And his mother is Na'ama the Ammonit. V'yas Yudah ha'rab b'enei Hashem, v'yekan'u oto mikol asher asu avotam b'chatot tam asher chatau. And he does evil. The question of which of the kings of Yudah are going to be evil and which are going to be good is one worth following. Rechavam is, for his 17 years, this is the king who does evil. What are the evils that he does? And they do worse things than their forefathers had ever had done. So what do? So in Pasuk of Gimel, it seems like they do what the north is doing. They build. So Bamot could theoretically be for worshipping Hashem. Could be altars, mizbechot, for worshipping Hashem. Of course, they're wrong now that Beit HaMikdash has been built, but that will be the lingering problem with Bamot that we'll see throughout the book of Malachim. Matzevot and Asherim is more difficult. Asherim would seem to be that they were also worshipping idols, although that, in Chazal's tradition, goes away fairly soon. And certainly the phrasing of Alkol Givag Givoha V'tachat Kol Yetzer Hanan is a phrasing that we see in the Torah, we see elsewhere in Navi, as reflecting idol worship. Ve'gam Kadeshi Haya Ba'aretz. And he also has prostitution. Kadesh, meaning women who are available for improper sexual activities, and they may have had a idol worship component to them. And they did it like all of the abominations of the nations that God had removed from in front of the Jewish people. And that's all that Navi tells us about, and we're going to finish up with Rechavam in a minute, but you wonder how this happens. You have, the time of the Shoftim was a time of difficulty, and there were people worshipping idols then. Then you have David, you have Shaul and David and Shlomo, which would seem, at least by the portrayal in Navi, to have been times fairly free of idol worship. The end of Shlomo's life, you have some of that coming back in, and then you have Rechavam, and all of a sudden you have it. Question is how it comes about. I think the answers are fairly obvious and fairly simple. Shlomo HaMelech has these many wives, and he has much interaction with the world around him, almost all of whom were idol worshippers, and he has the people bringing him gifts and this and this and this, and it tends to seep in. And I think what we're seeing, and we'll have to see the extent to which it continues in Yehuda and continues in Yisrael, maybe that they diverge on this question, but the question we have to be thinking to ourselves is, to what extent are they able to eventually learn to avoid that, to cut themselves off from it, and to handle it? So Shlomo HaMelech, by and large, at least in Chazal's tradition, by and large, Shlomo HaMelech knows how to avoid it. He interacts with all these people, but does not learn from them and grow from them. He does, however, this is the best you can do, get affected to the extent that by the end of his life, he's willing to allow them, his wives, to worship here, and Rechavam comes from one of those wives, Namaha Ammonid, and seems to have absorbed more from her than from his father, and that would seem to be the source of it. So the question of, again, as a what we call modern Orthodox, or whatever kind of Orthodox you like to think you are, the question of how much and to what extent we interact with the world around us, and the impact that has on us, and the effects that has on us, so that I think they're highlighted right here. Rechavam comes right after Shlomo. He's living in a very cosmopolitan world his whole life, and the result seems to be that when he becomes king, that cosmopolitanism wears off on him, rubs off on him. That's not going to be true for all the Malchei Yehuda, so we'll have to see which are which and how they handle it. Pasuk Chafei, Vayi Bashana HaChamishit LaMelech Rechavam, Ala Shishach Melech Mitzrayim Al Yerushalayim. In the fifth year of his reign, Shishak comes to Yerushalayim. Now the question, who is this Shishak? Whether it's Paro himself, so that would seem not to be true. Shishak would seem to have been a son of Paro, which would mean an uncle of Rechavam, not an uncle because Rechavam is the son of Naaman Moni, but the Rechavam's father's brother-in-law, Rechavam's stepmother, whatever. You understand the relationship. And he comes to Yerushalayim, Vayikach Rasot Beit Hashem, Rasot Beit HaMelech, Verakol Lakach. Vayikach Kol Magnei Hazav Asher Asah Shlomo. He comes and he raids the storehouses of the Beit HaMikdash and of the king, and he takes all these golden shields that we spoke about in the time of Shlomo. There is a Gemara that portrays this as being a continuing battle around this gold, that the gold started way back in history. It started with Adam and Chava, I think, and then it was eventually taken by Paro, and then when the Jews left Egypt, it was taken by the Jews with them, Vayinatlu et Mitzrayim, and that this is now Shishak's chance to get it back. And then there's back and forth throughout history as to who gets what gold, and then eventually it will come back to us. So it seems like the Gemara is portraying this battle over the gold is not so much over a specific money and specific gold as an epic sort of all historical battle over who's going to control the riches of the world. And the question will be, if the Jews have the riches, then theoretically they can use them for right and good purposes. If Pharaoh and Egypt and all that it symbolizes have the riches, then that will go for other things. And so that, to some extent, when you follow that Gemara, history is shaped by who is in charge of the gold and the money in that time. It's also worth following that the relations between Shlomo and Paro that led to him marrying a daughter of his, and that marriage, by anything we know of, was retained throughout Shlomo's life and was as healthy or as good as any of these kinds of marriages are. In the next generation already, Shishak is so unenamored of in fostering these good relations that he feels free to come and to take the gold by force. So Pasuk of Zion, Vayasa Melech Rechavam Tachtam Maginei Nechoshet, so he makes into their stead brass shields. Mifkida Yidei Sarei HaRatzim HaShomim Petach Beit HaMelech. And he gives them, he doesn't leave them anywhere now. He has them be in the watch and the care of the palace guards who guard the doors to the palace. Vayimidevo HaMelech Beit HaShem Yisaum HaRatzim Vayashivim Al Taharatzim. When he comes to the Beit HaMikdash, they would pull them out for the ceremonial occasion. And then when he was done, they would bring them back to the guarded chambers of this palace guard. So that image, the question is, why did the Tanakh go out of its way to tell us about this story? That Shishak came and took the gold, so that, especially if you follow that Gemara, that could be because it's trying to point out the downfall that had gone on in terms of this epic and continuing battle over this central gold that there was in the world. But why tell us about the replacement? So I wonder whether it's not possible that Rechavam is here trying to replace what was lost, and that the Tanakh is noting for us some of the, I don't know if it's pathos or silliness, or it depends on the attitude you carry with it, of Rechavam trying to act as if he still has a great ceremonial thing. So does he leave, he doesn't leave them lying around, I think perhaps because he's afraid of somebody else taking them. So he wants them always under guard. Once he has them always under guard, then when he comes out for a ceremonial state visit to the Beit HaMikdash, he has them bring them out to celebrate with him. And after all, remember, they're only brass, not gold. And then as soon as he's done with them, he has them return to the guard. So it's almost a mockery. He wants to show his wealth as much as he can, and yet he's so insecure in it that he can only take it out for ceremonial occasions, and he has to return it there as soon as he has, so it's always under guard. I think there's some of that balance maybe being highlighted for us by the Navi. The Rechavam is trying to hold on to a sense of regality, and he ends up looking a little ridiculous because he really only has brass instead of gold, and even the brass he can't be confident of holding on to unless he puts it under lock and key. Pasuk Chav Tev, V'yetu Divrei Rechavam V'chol Asher Asah Elohim HaKtivim Al Sefer Divrei Hayamim L'Malchei Yehuda. Same issue. You've got them. The history is in the history books, and look there. Then Pasuk Lamed, we find out U'melchama Hayta Ben Rechavam V'Ben Yeravam Kol Hayamim. So I mentioned before that we find out Yeravam had wars. Now we find out that some of those wars, at least, were fought against Rechavam, and that for all that Rechavam had an original message not to battle with Yeravam, later on, he goes to war. Question being, and here I think it's Rashi who says that later on he ignored Hashem's message. But the question is, did Hashem tell him never to battle Yeravam? Or was it only when the battle could possibly have been conclusive? Meaning early on in the kingdom of Yeravam, when the northern kingdom had just split off, so there, when it was first in its infancy, it's plausible to imagine that Rechavam was already well organized, and if he had come with his armies, he would have wiped out the kingdom, not wiped them out by killing all of them, I mean, wiped out the possibility of leaving and brought them back into the fold. That, he's told by a Navi, he's not allowed to do. He doesn't have that option, because that's Mehashem. But later on, once Yeravam has a well-established army and has set up his administration, so there a war back and forth, a war here, a war there, is over some territory, that apparently, I think that you could suggest, that Hashem never meant to deny Rechavam, and so we find out that in fact they fought all of their lives, which is a sad thing for the entire peoples, because it means that the northern and southern kingdoms split up so fully. Not only did they say we don't want Rechavam to be our king, but they were going to fight in self-defense, and Rechavam is going to fight to push the matter as much as he could. פסוק במן הלאה, וישכב רחבעם מאבותיו, ויקבר עם אבותיו בעיר דוד, ושמימו נעמה המונית, וימלוך אביהם בנו תחתיו. He dies, he's buried with his forefathers. Notice that, for all that he didn't follow their example as well as he could have, he does get burial with them, he doesn't get denied that, and we find out his mother, and then his son takes over for him. Questions we're going to have to want to follow is, are the continuing kings of Judah going to be negative as this one was, or is there going to be something that turns around about Judah that will distinguish it from Yisrael, meaning Rechavam is perhaps not as bad as Yeravam, but he's not great, and he's not seen as being great. We'll have to follow the history of the two kingdoms and see where it takes us. Have a great day.